Impact of Influence.
Covering true crime throughout the Southeast.
Hello, friend. Matt Harris here, and hello, Seton Tucker.
Hello. Friday.
Oh, yes. We're recording this on a rainy Friday. We'll get to the interview with your pops in a minute. We want to tell you that Impact of Influence is on Facebook. Through Facebook, you can find the Impact of Influence YouTube channel. And Seton has now found a different angle. So we're hoping that you all approve.
I made Matt switch seats with me because this is apparently the skinnier side.
reach out to us on those Facebook pages. As I said, rate and comment and share the episode and subscribe on the YouTube channel. And we're part of the Evergreen Podcast Company. Before we do the interview about the inmates and talking to media in South Carolina, little Alec Murdoch news off the top.
April Fool's Day, he is scheduled to be sentenced for his federal financial crimes.
So, I mean, he's already going to be in there a long, long time, but now I'm going to put things on top of it.
Yeah, so I don't know. I may try to go down, but that's spring break week, so I'm not totally sure if I'll make it.
It's in Charleston, right? I think it's in Charleston.
Yes, Charleston. Judge Gergel.
We'll be doing that one.
In front of him.
All right, well, let's bring in our distinguished guest.
Yes, so I'd like to introduce my dad, Matt Sambita. He is a graduate of Penn Law School, and he served as a clerk with the Federal Court of Appeals. He has over 30 years of litigation experience. He practices with a large firm that handles civil and criminal cases domestically and internationally. Welcome, Dad.
Welcome. He's a professor of law, too.
Oh, yeah, yes. Temple University professor.
Right. There you go. Well, welcome back to the show, Matt. Appreciate you taking some time to talk with us again.
Glad to do it.
Always a pleasure to have my dad on. Actually, we received a listener comment this week saying they always love when you're on.
Yep, that was from his wife.
Well, that's nice.
No, it was not from my mom. No, it was not. So we have been talking a bit this week about a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU of South Carolina against Brian Sterling in his official capacity as the executive director of the South Carolina Department of Corrections. And this lawsuit has to do with prisoners' communications with the media. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, let's start out with the First Amendment, because this is a freedom of speech issue. And the First Amendment basically says, or it says, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, the key here is the part that says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Not to get too technical, but the 14th Amendment, you know, makes the amendments basically apply to the states, such as South Carolina. Now, generally, incarceration, as you know, can lead to the loss of several important rights, as well as a person's physical freedom. Inmates, for example, lose their right to vote, their right to privacy, and even some of the First Amendment rights. Over the years, the Supreme Court has struggled to arrive at a consistent standard for the restriction of free speech in prisons, with some questions still unanswered to this day. So it's
state
still
by
somewhat
state
up in the air.
And we should note that South Carolina, these are not laws in South Carolina. These are policies that were set forth by the South Carolina Department of Corrections.
So is that why the lawsuit is names the gentleman that runs the thing,
yeah,
as
Brian,
opposed to suing a state or something?
Yes, because they're policies and they're not laws.
Yeah,
exactly right. And the regulations, really, not policies. It's these regulations that the Supreme Court has traditionally dealt with over the years, most frequently over the last 50 years. But it's fair to say that the South Carolina Department of Corrections enforces some of the most restrictive policies media access to prisoners in the country.
Let's talk about what those restrictions are.
Their ban stands out because it blankets basically any media interview that an inmate would want to do. And the theory they say is the reason they say they have this policy is it protects the rights of the victims, which I think can be kind of flimsy. Some other states.
Well, then, no, that's fair. They should not have to see the person who has committed a crime against them or their family member on national news every night.
Your lawyer will speak in a minute, but I would say, though, okay, if that's the real case, then you might be able to have a policy that says you cannot talk about the specific crime, but they can't even talk about misbehavior in the prison by prison guards, etc. Right? Am I right on that, Matt?
Yeah. Basically, what the South Carolina correction regulations do, or media policies, I think there are two regulations. And basically, it says the agency prohibits personal contact, interviews with any correction inmate, untried county state keepers, in other words, some with waiting trial but in custody, or death row inmates by anyone, and bans news and non-news media representatives from taking photographs or audio videos, recordings of the prisoners.
So it's everything.
So you're right. It's pretty restrictive, Matt. You're absolutely right.
What I found interesting in doing a little bit of research about this is a prisoner can have a member of the media. They can call them on the telephone, but that is not allowed to be recorded or even
used. Broadcast, however you want to use.
That's correct.
And other states have limit. I mean, other states allow certain, there's limitations on it, that who contacts who, how long they can talk, etc. But South Carolina is just like, you ain't talking to nobody.
Right. And, one of the interesting recent examples deals with your original thrust of your podcast, namely Alex Murdoch. And apparently, I think it was on August 8th of last year, the correction department learned Alex spoke to his attorney, Jim Griffin, and described his time in custody and read a portion of his journal to Jim Griffin.
Right.
Griffin recorded the call and provided the Fox Nation for inclusion in a documentary series. And apparently, none of the information contained in the call, I think everyone agrees, didn't implicate any way security within the prison. Mm-hmm. As a result, the South Carolina Division of Corrections revoked Alex Murdoch's tablet and phone privileges, and Jim Griffin received a letter from the correction people saying he violated policy and this could jeopardize the telephonic communication with Alex in the future. Now, that's interesting in itself, but then the more interesting thing to me is that apparently the Department of Corrections provided Fitz News with three separate groups of messages sent to Alex on the tablet that he was issued by them, as well as multiple audio videos of his that they recorded. And this included calls between Alex and his son Buster that were recorded by the South Carolina correction people. And that was played, as I understand it, on the Fox News documentary. So it seems like it's a little bit unusual the way it's been used. Now, the complaint relates to two prisoners. And just briefly, one is a transgender woman who killed her mom when she was 13 and was diagnosed while in prison with gender dysphoria and is suing the state prison over denial, I guess, of health care relating to this person's transition. The second is a death row inmate, a guy by the name of Marion Bowman, who was convicted of killing a woman and burning her body in a car trunk. Bowman wants to tell his story as he prepares to ask the governor for clemency.
He's on death row.
Exactly. And obviously, neither one of these people, based upon their crimes, seem very sympathetic. So the question then is, as well, what First Amendment rights really do they have? Now, just very briefly, which might add a little bit more framework to this. Let's talk about the Supreme Court law on this. And I won't get too much into the weeds. I'll talk in a more conversational way. Generally, a prison inmate retains only those First Amendment rights that are not inconsistent with his status as a prisoner or with the legitimate penological objections of the correction system. Now, it's interesting, that word penological is used in the complaint a number of times because that's a standard that the Supreme Court sets up. Then the Supreme Court over time has talked about the governmental interests which are at stake in the administration of prisons. And it basically lists three things. One is the preservation of internal order and discipline. The second is the maintenance of institutional security against escapes or things like that. And three is the rehabilitation of the prisoner. Just stopping there for a second. So you can see that the head of prisons, by coming forward and saying he's trying to protect the victims of these or the victims' families from these, I'm not sure it falls directly within that. I understand it's a worthy goal possibly on his part, but it really doesn't fall within those standards.
Especially in concern with the person who is having health care issues. I mean, that doesn't seem like that is related directly to her crime.
Yeah,
exactly.
Basic layman's terms. They anything that's going to cause an uprising in the riot, or the prisoner's going to figure out a way, you know, get help escaping, it's going to cause problems within the system, within the prison itself. That's the thing we're looking for.
And in the press release issued in response to this lawsuit by the South Carolina Department of Corrections, they talk about concerns that they have about safety. I mean, that's a primary concern. And also resources. They don't have the resources to have people monitor in-person interview with an inmate. I get the resource issue. I don't know that that's necessarily the case with the telephone call. But also, I think that especially the person who is having concerns about medical issues within the prison system, that's a separate issue than her crime.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
Where did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/impact50 and use code impact50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's impact50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
True. Right. There was one or two Supreme Court cases I just want to give you the flavor of, because that might put a little more, I think you go in the right direction, but a little bit more on it. Generally, the Supreme Court have sharply curtailed, I think it's fair to say, First Amendment rights of prisoners. When looking at free speech claims, the Supreme Court has displayed basically considerable reluctance to second guess prison administrators. All right. Mm. So in other words, it's a tough road to hoe on these things.
Right.
A number of cases are out there going about it. But the major case, I think, is probably the Turner versus Safely case decided by the Supreme Court in 1987, where the court upheld broad restrictions on inmate-to-inmate correspondence, and the process reaffirmed its commitment to deferential standards in prison speech cases, in other words, referring to the administrators. And in that case, Justice Day O'Connor, the first woman Supreme Court justice, set forward a test. And I think the test is important for this discussion. And it held that when a prisoner regulations impinge on inmates' constitutional rights, the regulation is valid if it is reasonably related to legitimate penological interest. And note, this is why, as I said, the ACLU uses that terminology.
All right, tell me that in layman's terms, because I don't totally get that. Explain it to me as a non-lawyer.
Yeah, well, you know what that means is that there has to basically be a rational connection between the regulations and the government's interest.
Okay. Yeah, like that makes sense? It means common, like a basic common sense kind of thing. Right. The lord of the prison and say you can never talk to anybody ever or whatever. You have to have some
basis.
Reasonable common sense reason. And prisoner to prisoner, right? I think that would be considered different than prisoner to media person, maybe, perhaps, right? Or no?
Yeah. And so, just to give you one example, I mean, you could see how it would be unduly burdensome on the cost of administration and the orderly administration of prison systems if prisoners were allowed to call press conferences.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. Yeah. So I think it'd be fair then to have, that's why you would have limitations perhaps, and the ACLU may end up be happy with limitations. I think what's getting everybody, get them fired up is it's so carte blanche if nobody's talking to anybody.
Well, you know, we have two defendants in this, or the two petitioners in this case, you know, the two cases they cite are these two inmates. You've got one with healthcare issues. That seems kind of legit. But then you also have another one seeking clemency. And they want to get the word out about why they feel that they deserve clemency. What are your thoughts on that?
That's right on point, Seton. Let's talk about what the positions of the parties are. As Seton rightfully said, or Matt, that the correction people have publicly said the policies to ensure the victim is not exposed to speech or expression of the prisoner. They say this is rooted in the victim's rights, that we don't think victims should have to see the person who harmed them or their family members on the evening news. That's basically what they say in their press releases and what they said. Now, the question is, does that really fall within those standards that we've been talking about? Now, what did the plaintiffs say, which I think is what you're really asking about?
Yes.
The transgender person says that they like to share information with the public so the public can make informed decisions about the propriety of transgender healthcare bans and hear about the physical and emotional costs of denying medical care to individuals with gender dysphoria. So I think you're absolutely right. It's a healthcare issue in summary. The death row inmate, you're right. What he wants to do is to increase political pressure in favor of clemency to shed light on capital punishment. In other words, he doesn't think capital punishment is right, of course. I'm not sure that's going to fly very well in South Carolina.
And
to inform the public about alleged inhumane treatment that's been endured by him and others during incarceration in the South Carolina system. Now, the idea behind both of these.
That's two issues. One is he wants to talk about prison conditions.
What it really comes down to in a nutshell, there's one really commonality here. And the idea behind both is that their stories are about is not the same by direct story by both. Namely, they say there is no substitution for public hearing their own voices, their own laugh, their own anguish, and experience firsthand their emotions and issues and situations. So what they're saying is, you know, it's different if somebody, if a newspaper guy writes a story about something rather than hearing directly from them. And that's really what their argument really is. And what they're really saying is that they ought to have some way of directly expressing their concerns and ideas to the public.
You know, I think one thing that would be an interesting angle when we talk about this is there are people who are convicted and there's a whole bunch of people in prisons that have only been charged. Do you think there could be a separate ruling based on that at some point? Or would that make logical sense?
Well, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor and the opinions I talked about, you know, basically say that if you've been convicted and if you've been charged, but you're incarcerated,
You know,
both those situations, they treat the same.
Okay.
I think you raised a good suggestion, though, Matt, that there are some differences between them.
This USA Today article that I read talks about this specific lawsuit, and they say that actually Martin Luther King Jr., when he was jailed in Birmingham, his letter talking about civil discourse and disobedience and how unjust the laws were would, in the state of South Carolina, not be able to be released to the press.
Right.
Well, there was a letter. Right. Are they allowed? They're still allowed to write. Are they allowed to write letters in South Carolina, or no?
I don't think they're allowed to communicate. Yeah. I don't think that's allowed to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could be wrong on that.
Right. It targets the prison's ban that prohibits inmates from directly publishing their own words, though they can be quoted in part or summarized in a publication. Okay, so there you go. So he couldn't do the whole letter.
They could not. The whole letter could not be published.
Right, right.
Well, I think actually that if they write a letter which describes the situation, that could probably be published. What they're really concerned about is the audio recordings and the videos and them directly expressing their points of view. So in other words, someone can talk about their concerns based upon writings and other stuff they get, mm-hmm. but they're not entitled to record and whatever. Now, you raise an interesting question, and I'm not sure it's decided yet as to whether or not if someone writes a letter to, the South Carolina Times, I don't know what the newspapers are.
The State Paper, Post and Courier.
Yeah.
Give a shout out.
Could they be published? I think they probably could be published as such and written about in various ways. But I think what they're really more concerned about is, audio recordings and videos. In other words, direct presentations by the incarcerated person. That's what they're really talking about.
This is so strange to me because we talked about this in many episodes, and I think you referenced it earlier, is that we can FOIA for telephone call, audio telephone calls. We actually have them between Alec Murdoch and his family members, and you're actually allowed, you can get, so what's to prevent somebody from talking to...
Because it's an interview at that point.
It's an interview at that point. You could actually, somebody could send someone, their family members, and ask them the questions that someone, and then a member of the media FOIAs it and gets the question, response to the questions.
That's an interesting call, because they did play all the phone calls in their entirety, many places.
Yeah, and it was a little bit weird that you felt like maybe the right to privacy, and we talked about this with John Snyder, the right to privacy among inmates, you lose certain First Amendment rights, the right to privacy, and you lose rights when you become incarcerated.
But what if it was a reporter on the other end of that call?
Exactly.
And they, instead of a family member, I see what you're saying. Yes, because what's the difference?
Exactly.
Well, think of it in the Murdoch case. Jim Griffin recorded what Alex told him, and that was viewed to violate the regulations.
Hmm.
So, in other words, if a newspaper journalist records and does that, that would violate it also.
Because they released them
to the media.
To the media, but it was this. But maybe it's the difference is the, which is a really disingenuous thing that that's the case. The Department of Corrections, they're kind of choosing what if they release it. I guess they're saying it's okay, right?
That's
one of the things which is going to hurt the state in its defense.
Okay.
For what you just said, Matt, for that reason. In other words, it's like, why should they be the ones to pick and choose what audio recordings are released?
I hear you. That makes sense. And it is. The Department of Corrections, they mentioned that in this article that they can... Inmates can approve reporters to be on their telephone list as long as their own words aren't recorded and rebroadcast, as we kind of mentioned earlier, and that the Post and Courier in Charleston wrote to more than 400 inmates and got letters back from at least 100, as reported on a 2018 prison riot, the Lee Correctional Institution, where 7 inmates were killed. But again, that's
a safety issue. Yeah. The prison riot stuff, that, like, I understand the Department of Corrections position with safety issues. Of course, they don't want to have any sort of media interview that may cause prison riots or...
But I think the ACLU is saying there should be some transparency and some, what would be the word I'm looking for, some sort of public accountability.
Yeah.
Where that prisoners can say, hey, this prison guard's beating me with a stick every night or whatever the heck it is.
Yeah, and what they're saying, what's so wrong with a prisoner being able to have a telephone conversation with somebody who can record it and then publish that conversation if relates to sort of issues we're talking about here. That's the gist of what the ACLU was saying, because that wouldn't put any really additional burden or cost on the state.
And it wouldn't be anything against the victims.
Yeah, because they're not talking about exactly, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the counter argument, of course, is that anytime these people speak, the victims get upset, you know, no matter what they talk about.
Right.
But you raise a good point.
And we do have to be sensitive to that. I mean, it you know, and I think that South Carolina having a very pro victim policies, or I think you said they weren't policies, regulations. You know, that is, I think, important.
Well, and it's a different world now too, right? So you really don't know where's the line on media, right? So you could just have a YouTuber could put a manifesto from every killer on death row. Or, you know, as before, you'd have like three networks, a couple newspapers or whatever. And there was a little bit of, you know, media and journalistic integrity. It gets a little hairier these days, right? Of what, who's posting something, you know, and that's when things get, because you could just let these guys ramble on for an hour and put it on YouTube. And that, I could see how that would be perhaps upsetting.
Yeah, and let me give you two examples, which I think probably the state, when it really raises its defense, is going to go beyond, you know, the victim sort of analysis we've been talking about. I think they're going to raise things like, you know, they can create a safety concern by talking to the press and just getting notoriety from the media's attention. I think they might also say in certain instances, you know, people belong to organized crime, and by talking to the press, they can send coded messages that could result in more crimes.
Sure.
I think they could say that they could create opportunities for the media to manipulate and deceive the public in various ways. And so I think those are the sorts of things you're ultimately going to see boil up to the top here by the state when they make when they put together their full defense here.
Do you think that it's possible that the end result will be a less, there will still be restrictions, but they might come, you know, peel it back a little bit just to at least get the ACLU to back off or something, give some more like restrictions as opposed to totally restricted?
Well, you know, I think it's fair to say that, as I think both you and Seton jumped on, that the healthcare issue is something which is easier to carve out some way for that person to express their healthcare concerns out there. But the death row inmate, I think, I know it's in federal court, but I think federal court down there is going to be a much tougher row to hoe for the ACL on behalf of that defendant, the death row inmate person.
Gotcha.
I mean, because basically what they're trying to do is to get it out to the public so they might be able to get some swell of support for their two-point belief that there shouldn't be the death penalty in South Carolina, mm-hmm. and that somehow he individually should get clemency for whatever other reasons he can come up with. And those are really best directed to the governor directly himself.
Well, yeah. It's a great good conversation. Appreciate you joining us again, Matt, and we will, I'm sure, talk again pretty soon.
And I think it's a bottom line that it's going to be a tough road for the ACLU, candidly, to hoe in South Carolina, because, you know, the prisoners themselves aren't necessarily, as murderers, sympathetic people.
Right, right.
And they're in there for a reason. You know, with that said, you know, one would think, as we logically express it and talk about it, that there ought to be some reasonable way for people to retain some First Amendment rights.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. All right. Thanks, Dad.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, son. Matt. Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting together with you for some beers some night, Matt Harris.
Heck yeah, man. Heck yeah. We got to do it for sure. I'd love it.
All right.
See ya. Always great having him on.
No, I love it. And hopefully we have a lot of listeners who are really into the legal stuff. If you're not, we'll be back to true crime. We're working on a couple of really interesting true crime stories, one in Bald Head, another one in Goose Creek.
Yeah.
So we've got some good stuff in the pipes.
And I wonder, did you listen to your dad with interest when he was talking about that when you were a teenager?
You know what is actually really interesting is my dad really did not talk to us about that kind of stuff.
Really?
We didn't discuss legal.
Ah.
I think I took an interest in it. always been interested in it, but he really kind of kept work and home life separate.
Gotcha, gotcha. Yeah, that's interesting. Something is creeping
in. Don't follow it down. Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy. And you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
She stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Clooghless.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth, and together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.